Welcome to the Whitaker Report podcast. I'm your host, Dean Whitaker, President and CEO of Whitaker Associates. In this episode, we have as our guest Vern Schultz. Vern is a Chicago area commercial real estate professional with more than 35 years of experience across brokerage, investment sales, land development, construction, and property management. His commitment to client success has helped organizations such as Willow Chicago, Kronos Foods, and SRAM achieve their objectives. Since joining Colliers in 1997, he has completed more than 1,000 transactions with a total value exceeding $2 billion. Please join me as we welcome Vern Schultz to the Whitaker Report podcast. Vern, how did you get started in this real estate business?
Well, I got started almost as a fluke. My father and I were in the engineering supply business, and I was calling on a lot of industrial companies in the pursuit of business for the industrial supply company. And I had to find something else to do. I looked at several different options and ended up, a friend of mine was in the commercial real estate business, and he suggested that I pursue it and what I thought about it.
And here you are many years later.
Yeah, right. 40 years later.
You've been in Chicago industrial real estate, commercial real estate business through multiple cycles. What were the early lessons that still guide you in your decisions today? What did you learn early on that you're still using in your practice?
Well, I'm a firm believer in the fact that if you don't see the buyer, you don't see the seller or tenant, and you don't see the, and you haven't touched one of those three things at least, and ideally all three is better, it's going to be hard to make a deal. I, contrary to those in my profession who will sit at a computer all day long and sending emails back and forth and arranging for showings.
You know, when we were preparing for our conversation, you said something that stuck with me, and that said, rather than be a broker, you'd rather be a partner with the client. And so you work hard to become a partner. And how does that change that relationship?
Well, what it does in terms of the relationship, and of course, your client has to be willing to be your partner and, mm-hmm. and trust you. So there's an element of trust that's handed over to you as the broker, and they believe in, or in quotes, trust what you're telling them. And it creates a real sense of obligation on your part that you're not just chasing the commission dollars. You're chasing what you truly believe and the data says is the best deal for the client.
From your vantage point, what changes in the last 10 to 15 years are structural and which are here to stay and which are others cyclical? So what changes are you seeing that are going to be permanent, and what other ones are kind of part of a cycle that we go through?
Well, clearly, what I think is going to have a great deal of permanence is some form of artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. What form that's ultimately going to take, I don't know. As I was reading the other day, artificial intelligence, AI, has acquired 800 million weekly users in 2 years. It mm-hmm. took the internet, I think, 10 years to get, not to maybe get to 600 million. And the phone has never gotten past 200 million weekly users in 13 years. So there's no question that those people who aren't adapting to using AI are going to have, they're going to be left in the dust.
And that's a lot of change in the short time we're going to be experiencing.
It was, I knew it was big, but when I read the numbers, it was shocking. What do I think is going to not survive? I don't know. I wish I could answer that. I know.
You know, there's a lot of things that are cyclical. They come and go. And so it could be certain types of properties hot
Oh,
at one time, and other properties
yeah.
not.
Okay, so right now data centers are extremely hot. That if you have a site or location that has access to just tremendous amounts of power, and ideally with some sort of source of a lake or water, a river to cool that power, the data center people will pay almost any price. For example, land in Elk Grove Village here, which has tremendous amount of power, sites are selling as high as $50 a square foot, and probably without that, they're probably $12 to $15 a square foot. So
Wow.
that makes a tremendous change. The warehousing is a function of obviously access to the expressway, but when warehousing has declined because of the tariff issues, people are buying. There was a big rush to load up the warehouses with product before the tariffs hit. Now that the tariffs are in place, people are working through their inventories. I had a client that I represented for probably 30 years, maybe, starting in 10,000 square feet on up to 700,000 square feet. And the tariffs, because of the nature of his business, importing everything from primarily China and selling everything through eBay, he's closed up.
Oh.
Well, he's in the process of winding the business down. He sold it to a competitor, but in a relatively short period of time, the business was dramatically downsized, dramatically.
Interesting. What indicators do you watch that tells you when the market is about to turn before it shows up in the headlines?
Well, what I see is I see the market is kind of like waves in the ocean. It's up, it's down, it's constantly changing. And then ultimately it gets to a point of calmness when it reaches the shore, or it crashes against the shore with some tremendous disruption in the market, and generally that means a drastic reduction in pricing. But if you, and I think we're getting there in terms of what we're talking about specifically right now would be warehouse pricing, and I think we're getting there. Prices are starting to level out. A year and a half ago or so, they were rising, rising, rising. Now they're leveling out. The next thing that's going to happen, they're going to start to decrease. And so the people who made deals a year ago are going to say, "Wow, if I could have or would have waited, I should put," for example, data storage users, it's just getting there, getting the power and getting the location.
Interesting. What type of users are actually making decisions right now? What do you see happening? You mentioned data centers being one. What else, what's active at the moment?
Well, besides data centers, the most active portion of the industrial market is food users, either distribution or manufacturing. And the reason for that, obviously, is everybody's got to eat, and we are eating out way more than we had ever done in the past. So you've got all of these ready-to-eat processing plants that are being built. And I'm noticing that one of my clients, Amy Lou Foods, who makes a fabulous breakfast, chicken breakfast sausage, they're now using internet influencers on Instagram
Oh,
or
wow.
TikTok
Interesting.
and their sales are going through the roof. So that's a dynamic that you never would have thought about using internet influencers.
The question was really, what's active in the marketplace? And you're saying that food was your third category, that and processed foods primarily, and a way to eat stuff.
So after data centers and food, then the only other thing, and it's not terribly active, but the very large spec industrial buildings, and I'm talking north of 1 million square feet, which sounds like a crazy number, but consumer-oriented companies, when they have to have a large building, 1 million, 1,500,000 square feet, for example, like M&M Mars just recently had a building built. But if there was a building up, it may not have met their locational preference, but getting to the market for companies that are involved in consumer products, getting to the market is far more important than, within reason, the rent they pay and definitely the location that they accept.
When deals are stalling, capital costs, labor power, trucking access, permitting, interest rates, what's causing things to become to pause? What's slowing down transactions?
Right now, it's the cost of capital and, equally important, the inability to access capital. Bankers will say, well, if I was lending money, I'd loan it at 6%, but I'm not loaning any money. Or they'll say, yes, we'll loan you money, but we want 35% equity. Well, in the boom periods, that debt was 4.5%, 5 at the most, and the equity was 10%, 15 at the most. So when you change those two metrics, the volume of construction and new product coming on market is dramatically reduced. There's so little new product coming on the market, it's really surprising.
Are most of the transactions now build to suit rather than spec buildings?
Currently, like I talked about, the ebb and flow of the waves, that goes when there's no product, which like now there's none, and you need a building, then you're gonna be doing a build to suit, which requires a lot more lead time. You have to plan way ahead because you've got to acquire the site, you've got to go through possibly zoning, and then you've got to bid the cost of the construction out, and those prices are all over the map, although they do appear to be coming down. So build to suit is replacing spec buildings because no one can convince lenders to invest that the returns are going to be worth the risk of the investment.
You mentioned earlier about the distribution centers and tariffs. Do you think tariffs are causing a delay also in making decisions?
Big time. Companies they're reluctant to place orders for product that they don't know that they can profitably sell. I'm not suggesting that if 20% tariffs were going to be in place and they were going to stay, the market would somehow adjust to that, although I would think it would adjust with lower overall volume. But with the tariffs being on and being off, and last week, or 2 weeks ago, Japan had a tariff. Now it's last week it was reduced, and who knows if it's going back on. And so a lot of people you talk to say, I don't know whether I can buy a product and deliver it to my customer at a profit.
That's very interesting. From the point of view of your typical industrial users, what are the top 10 non-negotiables that you see driving their decisions right now? What do they have to have?
Well, depends on what it is, but in terms of power, in terms of data centers, it has to be power. You don't have power, the price of the land is irrelevant. If you do have power, the price of the land is almost no no object. For a warehouser, it's going to be lowest, the most reasonable economic, total economic cost, which includes the rent on the building plus the real estate taxes and the utility costs. For manufacturers, then the number one driver is labor. If you can't get labor, they don't want the building if it's for free, because they have to have people who are going to operate the machines and drive the fork trucks to load the trucks. And the labor has to be, for a typical warehousing manufacturing company, has to be in some range of reasonableness. Labor costs for companies in data storage are, they're not relevant. They can pay a lot of money for labor because they have so few people that occupy a 300,000 square foot building.
And I wondered about the issue of immigration. Is that impacting some companies now in terms of having access to a certain group of workers?
Oh, absolutely. I used to, in a couple of years ago, if you were talking to people, they would say they really liked the Hispanic workers because, one, they were hardworking. Two, they always showed up on time. Three, if there was an issue with a particular worker, somehow that worker just didn't show up the next day, but a replacement was already in his place. And the guy who was sort of the consigliere of the team, they took care of that stuff internally. Now, some of the guys will talk about, well, one of my clients hired some people non-Hispanic, and at noontime they said, this work is too hard. Give me my pay for the day. And the guy said, well, you've only worked half the day. Give me my pay for the day, or I'm going to file a lawsuit against you. Mm-hmm. So he said, you know, it was easier to pay a couple of guys an extra 4 hours than it was to litigate the principle of whether you have to work or not. So the Hispanics are they're a desired class for the laborers.
So there are areas in Chicago where that's more accessible than other parts of the city?
Well, in the city, so that you have access to public transportation, although by and large, if you watch most vehicles that pull in, you know, minivans and sedans, you rarely ever see one person in the car. It's usually minivans, it's usually all three rows of seats are filled, and they have some kind of a deal where they work out where the guy who owns the car, they share the gas and the toll fees or whatever, and probably give him a little bit of something for the use of the truck, for use of his vehicle. But the closer you are to the city, which is the closer you are to the Hispanic population, the better off you're going to be if you're a manufacturer. I just recently did a deal with a company that we looked at two neighboring states, and we could have saved a lot of money, several hundred thousand dollars a year, but they did not want to take the risk of losing that Hispanic community, the labor force.
Let's switch gears a little bit here. I know that you've trained many, many brokers over the years, and you've had the opportunity to work at several different firms as well. What separates the average broker from the great ones?
A commitment to serving the client interest above their own, and a willingness to really put in all the dues paying hours that are required. Mm-hmm. And then to be not only empathetic to the client's needs, but to but to think outside the box, as is evidenced by, and I'll throw a plug in for you, but as evidenced by oftentimes, like, you know, I call you and say, hey, what, like, here's the challenge I have. It's not a normal kind of a building. I need somebody with a broader paintbrush than I have to, you know, and so those guys that are willing to invest the time to go out and find the people to help them.
What is the discipline or habit you've drilled into your young brokers that paid off over decades?
Never give up. I have numerous occasions, including one that's sitting on my desk right now, that I have to call later on today, of somebody that I have pursued for years. And over the weekend, he gave me a call and said, Vern, give me a call next week. I want to talk to you about a project. So you cannot ever give up. It's like the challenge that we have when we've used your service. It isn't that we can't identify who needs some real estate service. It's just a question of timing. So, like I used to say to young guys who were starting in the business, if you want to do every deal in Chicago, talk to every company every day, because you, one guy, when you could get into office buildings and go through them, one young guy came up, he says, boss, I just finished canvassing Sears Tower. Well, what should I do next? And this was when you could go in and knock on doors. There weren't security guards and everything. I said, well, the best thing probably is to go back to the top of Sears Tower and start over again. Because I said, between the time that you called on that guy at the top and you got to the bottom and got over here to tell me your story, somewhere in that building, somebody's needs have changed. They either are closing down a division or they're hiring six more people. Something's going on. So you just have to stay on top of the market.
What I'm hearing you saying is that change is constant. So the one constant in the marketplace is change. So
yeah,
things are changing all the time.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
What is one misconception clients have about what brokers do, and what should they be asking instead?
Well, I think a lot of clients assume that what brokers do is kind of the old put up a sign and wait. You know, they get a listing on a property and they get a sign up and maybe make a brochure or something like that. What they should be asking brokers is, how can we, the collective we, do better than we're doing now? And it gets back to my belief that the most successful real estate relationships are a partnership. If you're in competition with your client, it really makes it difficult, because you're in competition with other brokers and other properties going on, and so you've got to be hand in hand with your client.
Very interesting. That's the end of my prepared questions. I'm just curious about, what have I forgotten to ask, or what should we cover as kind of a wrap up?
We kind of covered the market. We covered who's active. Who's not
maybe
active?
Look towards 2026, since it's right around the corner. What does next year look like?
Next year looks to me to be very stable. I don't think you're going to see massive vacancies or stuff, because there's not a lot of product on the market. Owners or landlords should understand, it's my belief that our vacancy level is not a relevant metric for the terms of leasing or marketing success. And what I'm saying is that if I came in and I made a presentation to your company and I said, Mr. Whitaker, there's only 4% vacancy in Chicago. Well, I think right now it's probably 6. There's only 6% vacancy in Chicago right now. And I can tell you that equilibrium is somewhere around 9%. So when it's more than 9, it's in the tenant's favor because there's more product. And when it's less than 9, it's probably in the landlord's favor because there's more prospects than there are properties. Right now, we're at 6%. So you would think it's really in the landlord's favor. And the answer to that is, or the explanation to that is, yes, it is in the landlord's favor for that specific unit of opportunity that you're pursuing. But in the picture of the overall market, what's really important is how long your product takes from the time that it hits the market until it is leased or sold. And right now, in general, for all categories, it's somewhere around 18 months to 2 years.
Ooh.
And I think that and this is in Chicago. I'm sure it's different in Dallas, or it might even be worse in Los Angeles. I don't know, because it's so heavily dependent on the intermodal. So that's what's really important, because as I've said to people in the past, when your building is empty, it's kind of like the definition of recession or depression. When your building is empty, it's a depression. When your neighbor's building is empty, it's a recession. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is really, really important. And the client needs to understand that in his submarket and in his product size or category, you could be looking at 2 to 3 years in average turnaround. So now, as his agent, what am I going to do to change that? And the obvious answer is, is it the right clear height? Does it have the right office, the right diet? It gets really tough. So,
very Andrew, that's a great observation, Vern. I'd like to thank you for taking your time today.
Thank you.
Appreciate the chance to talk with you. You and I have worked together for many years, and so it's a delight to have this conversation. And we look forward to hosting you at the Whitaker Report podcast in the future. So
thank you.
Thank you very much, Vern.